Hi there, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you with the Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial with you for 2 hours today with Linda Vanella. Linda, glad to have you here.
Thank you, Armand. I'm glad to be here.
Hey, today we're going to bring you two things that I think are really important. 2 hours today. First, we're going to help you look at aggression and from different aspects of aggression, things you have not figured before, but more, well, also as exciting, is some new research on why and what makes people get this feeling of happiness. Now, happiness is an elusive kind of thing. Because I remember someone from Japan once saying to me, I wonder why Americans are so concerned with being happy. As if happy is something. What is happy? Well, let's not say happiness. Because that could be a momentary thing. It could be transient. It could be you're laughing. You see a good movie. Have a good meal. But a sense of happiness, that's a real question. What leads to that? For example, why do couples go on having children, even though the data clearly shows that parents are less happy than childless couples? If a couple doesn't have any children, they're generally happier than people with children. Interesting thing. Why do billionaires desperately seek to make more money when there's nothing they really want to do with it? You know, it's not like, oh, if I get my next billion, I'm going to buy some flowers. No. No, it's just you get in the game of it. Why do some people keep joylessly playing at casinos? You know, sitting in front of, why do people take buses to casinos to sit in front of slot machines and pull the slots? And if you look at them, they're not happy. And they're not even happy when they win. There's a kind of a jolt when you win, an excitement when you win, but there's something about it. Now, this is not a judgment. Of course, we could sit around and say, those are empty things. You should not do this. You shouldn't be a billionaire making $2 billion. Well, let's not judge it. Let's try to understand it, because I think if we work at understanding, we may find some secrets for ourselves to increase our own level of happiness. And the question is, of course, those who do not have usually criticize those who do have. So it's easy to say, look at them, they need a bigger house, they need a bigger car. Well, yes, they could afford to. So instead of criticizing them, let's try to understand them. Maybe by understanding them, we could befriend them and they could wind up donating to WBAI, because we are the station who is representing them as well. Many people want to win for its own sake, even if it brings no positive emotion. Now, there's a Dr. Seligman, who's a professor of psychology at the University of Pennsylvania. He says they're like hedge fund managers who just want to accumulate money and toys for their own sake. Now, if you don't know the hedge fund manager phenomena, you have to know them, because I do. I used to work in Wall Street many, many years ago. And so people who needed psychological help would consult with me, because I understood the markets as well. And since I understand the market, and I understand the mind of the people who are traders and accumulators, and they all seem to live in Connecticut, you know, somewhere around, they all have a house right there in one of those near five towns, something, you know, no more than an hour and 15 minutes away from the city. But there's loads of houses and millions of dollars in houses and cars and families and so on and so forth. Why? What is that about? And what is it about? I mean, is it accomplishment? Is accomplishment the human goal in itself? Now, that's a complex concept. Is accomplishment the goal? Is painting a painting? Is finishing the painting the goal of painting? Or is painting the goal of painting? Is finalizing a music piece the object of the musician? Or is it getting there, learning the music piece, getting the piece? I often wonder what it's like to be somebody who plays the same music over and over again. Same perfect piece, like Schubert, you know, Opus 100, the third movement, where it's like such a perfect piece of music. And you hear it, but imagine if your job, if you did it so well, you played your cello so well and you played your harpsichord so well that you just kept playing the same thing over and over again. Does that feel like more and more expertise? If you're performing in a play on Broadway and you're at your 100th performance, do you make it more exciting? You know, I'm lucky. We have WBAI and I have the Positive Mind. Because I could always keep learning and changing things. It's never the same. I mean, it actually is very similar to other times I've been on the air because the feeling comes through it, but it's always a little different. I don't know what I could do if it had to just repeat. That's why I'm good at consulting rather than doing therapy any longer, because I've done a lot of therapy with people, and I repeated, and the process is repetition, and I understand the process. Instead, I got a group of people who work with me, and they do it very willingly because they're newer at it. Me, I've heard so many stories for so long. What I want to do is see people for one or two times and no more than that because of the newness of it, and it's a great adventure. The excitement of learning about people and seeing people and their minds and their feelings unfold. If you know how to do it, you know, if you become good at being able to understand people, it's a wonderful tool, wonderful thing to ask people to show you who they are when you could easily understand it. You know, it's not nice to ask people to speak to you in French if you don't understand their French. If you're just enjoying the language, that's one thing. But if you're going to enjoy if you hear the language and understand the language, it's so different. Well, the same with psychology. But people who are gamblers, let's go into that. Is it about accomplishment? Is it about the end result? A feeling of accomplishment contributes to what ancient Greeks called eudaimonia. Eudaimonia, E-U-D-A-I-M-O-N-I-A, eudaimonia. Eudaimonia? Then what am I? Eudaimonia, which roughly translates into well-being or flourishing. Now, flourishing, and that's a very important feeling according to a couple of people. It's Dr. Seligman at University of Pennsylvania wrote a book about flourishing. He says, what we're looking to do is flourish. That's an interesting concept. Are you flourishing? Do you feel like you flourish? Did you flourish once in your life and you no longer flourish? That's interesting. Are you yet to flourish? Well, we're going to have to look at what flourishing is. But it certainly is a feeling. If you look in your garden or you look at the plant that you're growing or you look in the park, I was looking at the park this morning as I was going through the park, and it's not flourishing yet, but it's ready to flourish. We call it RTF. It's getting ready. You can see it's just kind of all green now, you know, but it's going to blow up. It's going to flourish. The summer is coming. Now, so Seligman created an acronym called PERMA, P-E-R-M-A, which he defines these five critical elements of well-being. He says, one, it's got to be positive emotion for it to have a feeling of well-being. Well, is that true? You know any people who have negative emotion who have a feeling of well-being? Yes, I do. I mean, there are people who are negative, like a negative comic, like somebody who's telling who walks around negatively, they could feel good and just be sourpusses. They could have their own sense of, I mean, maybe it's not George Costanza, but maybe it's there could be a certain negative to you if that's your approach to life. Engagement is another element that he talks about. Now, that's very important, the feeling of being lost in a task. Now, if there's ever been, when I'm preparing a radio program or when I'm preparing doing some work, I love the engagement part of it. You know, I love the being lost in a task. Could be learning music. It could be doing research. It could be, I love that. Love it. Don't you love it when you're lost in a task? Even if the task is cleaning your house. You get lost in it, you know. Or if you're Michael cleaning your kitchen. You know, you just get it in order. Get it all. And you get in the process of it. And that flourish feeling kind of comes along with it. Now, according to this theory of eudaimonia, or the theory of flourishing, you also need to have relationships, meaning, and well-being, and accomplishment. So, to have this feeling of perma, which is called flourishing, you need positive emotion, engagement. That's the one being lost in a task. Relationships, meaning, and accomplishment. Well-being cannot exist just in your own head. Well-being is a combination of feeling good as well as actually having meaning. But then also having meaning, good relationship, and accomplishment. That feeling of well-being comes with some accomplishment, which kind of brings us around to understanding people who are parents, which we're going to get to a little later in the program. This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind, bringing you ideas about well-being and how you can achieve it on your own. And then later in the program, I'm going to be presenting you some stuff about aggression that'll just knock your socks off. So be sure to stay with us. We're going to be here till 3 o'clock today from 1 to 3. But let me continue with this right now. I want to have some music for you, some music to die from. You know, if I'm going to be on the air for 2 hours, I need to get 10 minutes of music squoze in there somewhere, because if I can't bring you new music ideas, I don't know what I'm going to do with it, because they ring around in my head all the time. So I want to bring them to you. I want you to hear some special stuff. The positive psychology movement, which is part of what I was or what I am, and it kind of was limited to this idea that everything should be positive. But that's not the best thing to judge. So we studied 23 European countries so that they, it was Timothy Sowe was a guy and Felicia Hubert at the University of Cambridge, and they were asking 23 European countries how they scored on these scales. Who do you think was the highest, happiest folks? Which people felt the most sense of flourishing? And I'll just guess, you know, if you're going to guess, England, France, Portugal, Russia, Italy, Switzerland, Denmark, Finland, what would you think were the two happiest, if not happiest, but sense of satisfaction? Well, they were Denmark and Switzerland. Denmark and Switzerland ranked highest in Europe, with more than a quarter of the citizens meeting the definition of flourishing. And near the bottom, with less than 10% flourishing, believe it or not, were France, Hungary, Portugal, and Russia. I understand Hungary, Portugal, and Russia. I don't understand France. I don't understand. I mean, how could you not feel flourishing in France? Right? But obviously you don't. Which makes you do silly things in hotel rooms or something. Now, there's no direct comparisons available with the United States because too much of it was mixed up. But they have a sense that Americans report, 51% of Americans report feeling satisfied with their work at least. 51%, you know, that's like the highest rate in the world. But that's not necessarily what yields what we're talking about. Now, people finding meaning and providing unconditional love also for children. And this is another very big part of this. If we have children, your happiness drops significantly when you have children. When you have children, you got to deal with diapers, you got to deal with noise, tantrums, backtalk, and all that stuff. Why would anybody who is a happy person have children? Right? Because there's a paradox here. Because the willingness to accept the unhappiness that comes with raising children raises your happiness. It's a different kind of happiness, as Linda said to me. You know?
For sure, Armand, yes. It's a different kind of happiness. It's a flourishing that comes with great satisfaction. So, yes, there is a chore of raising a child, but there's also great rewards and other kinds of
It's a different
happiness.
Kind of feeling.
It's a different kind of a feeling, yes. Yeah.
You know, it's like breastfeeding. You know, people don't talk about how good it is to breastfeed. And, you know, sometimes they're afraid to talk about it because they have a sense that, oh, maybe it's erotic or sexual or something like that, which I'm sure it is as well. But there's something about it, as uncomfortable as it is. It's like, you know, it's not only the baby who needs the breastfeeding, it's also the mama. Isn't that true?
For sure. Again, you're seeing a part of your body that's that has this gift to give life to a child. It's a very different kind of a satisfaction and a reward that one like myself, I had never experienced something like that prior. And the first experience was, yes, a little uncomfortable physically, and yes, of course, your whole sexuality and that whole feeling of exposure, but the reward and the satisfaction along with that chemical hormonal kind of sense of your body is a wonderful, wonderful feeling of flourishing happiness and joy.
So if we just wanted positive emotions, if that were all we were focused on, our species would have died out many years ago because by being willing to accept unhappy emotions, we have children. And we have children to pursue other elements of well-being. We want meaning in life, and we want relationships, and children help us have meaning. And children help us have relationships. So now there's a further experiment, so that's about the children, and we're just going to go a couple of more minutes before I'm going to ask you to call into our station. There are some experiments they found of learned helplessness. Now, this is kind of an interesting thing. If you gave people a series of arbitrary rewards, do you know that they stop doing anything constructive and their happiness drops? We found that when a good thing occurs that isn't earned, like nickels coming out of a slot machine, it does not increase people's well-being. If you drop a gift on people, it does not necessarily increase their gift. If you're anonymously generous, it does not necessarily make them feel good. In fact, it's the opposite. It produces helplessness. People become more passive. So be careful what you give and when you give it. Keep the basic elements in mind. Keep that we're going to be, look at the basic elements of well-being, identifying which ones matter to you the most. Setting goals, monitoring progress in your own way. What are you doing spending your time that way? How do you spend your time? Can you make some shift in just percentage of your time to do a little more in one thing or another that you enjoy more? And by monitoring this, by keeping an eye on it, you can start to actually increase your own sense of flow. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. We're here today for 2 hours with you, and we're going to bring you some really remarkable stuff about aggression. And remember I told you about the Schubert piano in E? We're going to take a short break because I haven't heard any breaks on the program in a little while. And then we're going to start making calls. Well, before we do, here's something we want you to do. Hold on.
Armand.
Up. There it is. Hold on a second. 212-209-2950. My mistake. 2900 is the station. 212-209-2950. March of the Toys, 1940. I guess it was kind of military music in a way. But that's quite a piece. It's the joy in your heart. Aggressiveness. Aggressiveness. Aggression. In psychology, as well as in other social and behavioral sciences, aggression refers to behavior between members of the same species that is intended to cause pain or harm. Now, that means predatory or defensive behavior between members of different species is not considered aggression, according to psychology. That means, in other words, if you're an animal and you're a bird, you're an owl, and you're going to catch a mouse. That's not aggression. But if you're a mouse who wants to hurt another mouse, that is aggression. Owl against owl, that's aggression. Predatory. If you're an animal who is just trying to hurt another animal, right, as I've seen people with their pets sometimes it just kills me to see people hurting their pets, and you wonder if they're just doing it to hurt the pet. I've seen children do that with animals, you know? Whack, I'm just going to punish something. I'm just going to pass along the punishment. That's aggression. But usually, if it's predatory, meaning you're going to get something to eat, right? That's not considered aggression. And if it's by our definition. So it's not aggression if you go out and you mow the grass. You know, you mow the lawn. Is that aggression? You're cutting off the poor grass. You know, you're going to chop it at its head. You're going to cut it down. What do you think? Or you're going to pull that potato out of the earth and you yank it out of the earth. Is that aggression? Right? Okay. Now, aggression takes a variety of forms among humans. It could be physical, it could be mental, or it could be verbal. Now, that's not to confuse aggression with assertiveness, because the terms are often used interchangeably. You know, people say, like, an aggressive salesperson. When they say that, they mean an assertive salesperson, but you see, since the salesperson is kind of hurting you, and very often salespeople look at you as prey, and they don't look at you just as, you know, somebody, and they actually feel angry at you because they know that you're going to purchase, you could or could not purchase their product. And so sometimes people who sell things are assertive when they're selling, but sometimes they're aggressive too, and you could feel it. You could feel an aggressive salesperson if you say no, and they want to hurt you. They really want to, I want to smack you. And, you know, I'm sure if any of you have ever served people in a restaurant, yeah, you've had some of those feelings yourself. Well, that's not assertive. That's aggressive. Aggressive is wanting to cause harm, wanting to hurt. Now, that's for this exploration only. You know, that doesn't mean that you have to agree with it or not agree with it. But for the sake of what we're talking about, let's use that as a definition. There are a couple of broad categories of aggression. They include hostile aggression, affective aggression, retaliatory aggression, predatory aggression, or goal-oriented aggression. And these are all, we're going to get to all of these. There's a critical difference between the two, both psychologically and physiologically. Some research indicates that people with tendencies towards affective, affective, aggression, defined in this study as being impulsive, unplanned, overt, or uncontrolled. People who have a, in other words, your aggression comes from your feelings. That's the affective part. Affect means feelings. People who tend to be impulsive, unplanned, overt, or uncontrolled aggression have lower IQs than those who have predatory aggression, which is defined here as being something that is goal-oriented, planned, hidden, or controlled. Let's think about that. So people who react from their gut. I just had a response from my gut. Boom. Right? Or somebody on drugs. Right, aggression on drugs, PCP. I'm familiar with PCP aggression or steroids. You know, aggression. It's like reactive. Pew, real fast. That usually suggests an altered state of mind, or a lower IQ. Lower IQ meaning that you don't have the mind to figure things out. And you feel frustrated, and we're going to talk about frustrated aggression. And so what you do instead is you strike out, hurt that person that makes you feel powerless or helpless. Like most behaviors, almost every behavior we have, let's look at aggression as how it helped us survive. It seems kind of obvious, you know? But there's going to be some very interesting things here that I think you're going to find. This is Armand DeMille, by the way, with Linda Vanella helping out and helping me with the research here at WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial, bringing you stuff that you don't know about aggression. And we're doing it at the time during our fun drive. When I say you don't know, I mean maybe you do know, but maybe you haven't thought about it at this level. We are talking about aggression. Now I want to talk about aggression and how aggression developed in the human species, because it'll teach you something about how we behave now. Now, animals may use aggression to gain or secure territories, as well as other resources like food, water, and mating opportunities, right? That's what animals mostly do. Give me territories where I could feel good. You know, I'll fight you for that cave. I'll fight you for water. I'll fight you for food. And I'll fight you for mating opportunities. To the point where the capacity for murder are products of this evolutionary past. Murder, to kill. The most apparent type of aggression is that seen in the interaction between a predator and its prey. Now this, you've just, you know, that's all you have to do. You see a hawk, right, and a sparrow, and that's it. I mean, you just don't see any more. That's as about as apparent as it gets. But again, this is predator and its prey. Interspecies. Interspecies is a different thing. When somebody is out to hurt somebody and that somebody else is the prey and they are the predator, that's a different form of aggression. An animal defending itself against a predator becomes aggressive in order to survive and to ensure the survival of its offspring. So aggression had to develop in order to protect yourself. Remember then also what we learned about recently about oxytocin. Oxytocin, a human hormone, which we always thought of as the bonding hormone, also has the capacity to get us to bond with each other and to turn against outsiders. You know that feeling of anybody from the outside is no good? Anybody outside of WBAI is bad, right? Anybody outside of New York is no good. Anybody outside of our town is, anybody off Manhattan, right, is the enemy. Anybody out of Central Park, right? Anybody out of this rock. When I was a kid, I grew up in the Lower East Side of Manhattan where there were gang wars. And the gang wars were turf wars. And they were turf wars over things like two blocks. These two blocks belong to us. Don't walk on these blocks. It was like, we were fighting over that. This is my two blocks. Where's your two blocks? We were as primitive as you could get. We were just functioning on every piece of our DNA. No intellect involved. Right? We didn't think one thing. We just behaved. Well, some of us got out of it. Now listen to this. This goes gets even more interesting. Because aggression against a bigger enemy or group of enemies would lead to your death or the death of an animal, animals developed a sense of when they're outnumbered. Now, unless you have a little dog, if you have one of the little yappy dogs, you know, little dogs, sometimes you see them attacking a horse. They don't have a sense that they're outnumbered. They somehow have lost a sense. Like they're going to go after the Great Dane or the St. Bernard or the big Doberman Pinscher. And it's just a little dog. Rah, 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 rah. It's going to rip its heart out, right? So some animals do not have a sense of that they're outnumbered. However, it's very important that we did develop a sense of being outnumbered. So we, humans, developed a sense of, or all animals develop a sense of being outnumbered, and therefore, instead of fighting back, which is what our natural tendency would be, somebody fights with you, you fight back, we developed this skill called fight or flee. Flee, something that makes you itch. No, fleas, F-L-E-E, flee. The flee impulse is to run away. Now, there's a third form, which is called freeze. There's fight, flee, or freeze. Some animals freeze in their spot. They don't move. And they find that they could escape attack that way. Other animals fight back. And other animals flee. So being able to flee, those of you who have a fight or flight response, thank your lucky stars that somewhere in your heritage you learned that it was smart to run. Get out of there. Go away. Don't deal with it. The enemy is bigger than you are. 212-209-2950, in case you forgot our phone number, by the way. The phones are silent. We need you to call in. Now, this gets even more interesting, my friends, and I hope you're captivated by this because I am. This is really, really interesting. The need to survive doesn't only go for you, you know. It's a whole species thing. We need to keep the species going. But this leads to a concept, a phenomenon known as altruism. Altruism, you know, are you being altruistic? Yes, I'm being altruistic. What does that mean? Altruism means that you are sacrificing yourself or a part of yourself for the benefit of another. In nature, animals will be altruistic when they act, when they put up an alarm call when a predator is approaching. You know what I mean? Let's say that you're a deer and you see a tiger, leopard, or somebody else coming your way. You set up the call. Right? And that tells everybody, get out of here. Well, now here's the disadvantage of this. Because you're the one who sounds the alarm, you're most likely to be the target of the aggression because they could spot you easily. So altruism comes from the fact that you may be sacrificed for the sake of the tribe. Isn't that interesting? Isn't that interesting? I never thought of it that way. Piano Trio in E-flat major, opus 100 by Schubert. Hell of a piece. It's on the album. I like the rendition that's on the album, Barry Lyndon. You get some nice surprises with that album, Barry Lyndon, from the movie Barry Lyndon. 212-209-2950. We're talking about aggression. Can you aggress? Do you aggress? Aggression, aggression, aggression. It's just amazing. There are many different theories to try to explain how males and females developed different aggression tendencies. Like if you think about the lion, who's more aggressive, the lion or the lioness? Right? Isn't that interesting? Who do you think is out there hunting? You think it's the lion or the lioness? What do you think?
Lion.
It's a lioness. It's mostly females doing the hunt. See? So, one theory states that in species where one sex makes a higher parental investment than the other, the higher investing sex is the resource for which the other sex competes. In the majority of the species, females are the highest interesting sex. So here's what the female has to offer. If it comes to having babies, the female is going to be the one with the biggest investment. Therefore, the males have a lesser investment. The male's investment is to just spill as much seed as possible. That's their job. Anywhere, you know, just wherever it could drop, let it drop because that's my job. You know, if it's somebody at the office, if it's a neighbor, that's my job. My job is just to, you know, be a seed spiller. And a woman's, a female job is to take that seed and nurture that seed and be specific about who she selects, hopefully, and to try to pick from the strongest and so on and so forth. But therefore, the competition is among the seed spillers for the seed receivers. I know this is silly talking, you know, what we're really talking about, because we all know this. So male reproductive success is constrained by the number of partners that they can mate with. As a result, males employ physical aggression much more than females. They take risks in order to compete with each other, with other males, and gain an elevation of status. So if I want to have more seed receivers, I hate to say I, if one wants to have more seed receivers, what one would do is to fight off the other seed receivers and let everybody be scared of you. So you go to the gym. You know, let's say you're an albatross, a male albatross, and you want to fight off all the other male albatrosses. You go to the gym, you work out. Can you picture an albatross lifting weights? Right? The albatross lifting weights, doing leg lifts, you know, running on the treadmill, developing themselves. They get bigger, 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 right? Mm-hmm. May even take steroids. And so then you become the prime albatross, and therefore you get all the albatross girls, right, to be attracted to you. And they say, "Ooh, what nice muscles. Will you please mate with me?" Now, therefore, it is the job of the male to have some quality that makes them more attractive to the females, and also with which the other males cannot compete. So it's very important that men try to elevate their status. Now, what males do is they elevate their status by going along, and if they can't become, let's say you're just, you know, you're only 5'7". In a world of 6 foot people, what do? Well, you develop another quality. You see, you develop a hairdo, you develop a style, you develop a sense of humor, you develop something else, or you become artistic. You know, back in the caves, females selected the cave drawers. How do we know this? I mean, did somebody write a note? But the guys who drew on the back of the caves were more selected than the guys who were hitting people over the head and dragging them inside the caves. Now, why were they selected? Because the creativity was a sign of intelligence, meaning that you're going to be able to produce for me better when the resources run out. See, I don't need a guy who just hits somebody over the head, because as soon as the resources run out, you're not going to be able to do very good for me. But give me that guy who's drawing on the wall. I know he's going to be able to think of something. And that's where poets and singers and bards, and that's where all that comes from. It comes from us seeing it, perceiving it as a form of kind of exquisite intelligence that could remove us from the ordinary struggle of every day. Now, back to men. Males go as far as killing one another, although it's rare. It's very rare that males competing for the same territory or female will kill each other. They usually don't. It's just beat you down, send you away with your tail between your legs. That's it. I'm done. I don't have to keep coming after you. Just don't come back. Right? Get out of the neighborhood. Don't come back to the neighborhood. Do not have to do you in completely. Now, that may be wise, because then that male goes off to another neighborhood where he picks on people smaller than him. And therefore, maybe he could thrive that way, because it's not only the strongest that survive, it's the medium guys as well. Females compete with one another. Now, how do women compete with one another? They beat each other up? You know, one would wonder, if you look at the nail salons, what they're doing, sharpening those nails and having them pointed, and then pointy shoes. And is that the technique? Is it ready for war? No. The health of will and well-being of females would cause them to be less aggressive, low risk, because they have to bring up the babies. They can't take the risks. If you take a male and he takes a risk and he gets kiboshed, right? Kibosh is the word. Kiboshed. Well, it's all right, because there's another male around. But that female, she's got the job to do, so she can't afford to go out there and just compete. She can't afford to go out there and be physically aggressive. We're talking about aggression. She can't go out there and say, "I'm going to beat that other woman over the head because she went out with my man." I mean, they do that on Jerry Springer, of course. But it's like, you know, she's not going to go hit somebody. No, she does it in a different way. females convert, females are less aggressive. They rarely inflict serious damage on one another over resources. When translated to humans, women could be expected to show evidence of dominance hierarchy than men do in society. What women will do is they'll get at you in a different way. They're going to get at you through social status. Aggression in women focuses mainly on resource acquisition and not status. It's more likely to take physically, to be less physically dangerous and more covert forms of indirect aggression. But that's why the house has to be so big. You see, I've got to have resource acquisition, not status from physical health. I got to have things. And if I have things, I mean, do you ever wonder why? What do you want such a big home for? Back in the, when we had this whole craze about everybody buying a home, you know, and people were going out there. It was like the thing was sparked. The competition was sparked. And the women would say to their husbands, oh, my God, you look like such a wimp because I have such a small house. You must look like a bigger man if you get me a bigger house. And the men were saying the same things. I got to look bigger than the other guy, so I got to have a bigger house. And so they got bigger houses and bigger houses and bigger houses. And, of course, that all collapsed. Never works. Never works. The taller your mountain goes, you know, the rain's going to come along one day. Now, humans share aspects of aggression with non-human animals. They differ from most of them in the complexity of their aggression because of factors, and there are certain factors that make this a little more complex. We're talking about aggression and the way people are aggressed, but there are three aspects: culture, morals, and social situations. Now, culture is very important when it comes to aggression, because if you come from a culture where people are aggressive, right? Where people are just naturally beating each other up, slapping each other around, hitting each other and killing each other, then that's part of your culture. I remember a boy who was telling to me, you know, where I grew up, everybody was always hitting everybody. And being beaten was like part of our childhood, you know, and I don't mean this is, you should not feel too sorry for us. Because everybody, the teachers hit us, the camp counselors hit us, our parents hit us, the priests hit us. That's what they did. It was a culture of hitting the kids, you know? And, I mean, little wonder that they hit each other, that they got into such fights. But that was that culture. And it was like we said, you know, the low end of the intelligence scale tends to resort more to physical aggression. It's only when you get skilled at it do you later get, you know, later in life decide that there are other ways of doing it. But going back to the culture, plays a role in aggression. Kung Bushmen, the K-U-N Bushmen, were described by Elizabeth Marshall Thomas in 1958. She did a paper and she called these people the harmless people. These were Bushmen. However, other researchers who did further studies on it noted that the homicide rate among the Bushmen is actually higher than of the developed societies, and that the peaceful savage is a myth. It's unsupported by the bulk of anthropological and archaeological evidence, including meat eaters versus vegetarians. Right? There is no evidence, unfortunately, because I wish there was, that says that vegetarians are less aggressive than meat eaters. Of course, if you're enough of a vegetarian and you wind up depleting your protein and all your muscles and you wind up, you know, being weak, and, you know, of course you're going to be less aggressive because you're going to be weak. But it is not by nature of the fact that you're aggressive that, you know, an animal eats an animal that makes it more aggressive. No. I mean, dogs eat dog food. You know, dog food is meat. It doesn't mean that the dogs are necessarily aggressive because they're dogs. Hunter-gatherer societies do not have possessions to fight over, but they still come into conflict over status and mating opportunities, and they're highly aggressive with each other. Now, listen to this one. This is interesting culturally. American men resort to physical aggression more readily than Japanese or Spanish men. Whereas Japanese men prefer direct verbal conflict more than American and Spanish counterparts. So a man from Japan will shout right in your face and decide, and we'll do it this way, you know. Well, the Spanish and the American men, when compared with it, no. They would much rather go to physical aggression than the Japanese. Within the American culture, Southerners, people from the South, are shown to become more aroused and to respond more aggressively than Northerners when affronted. So if you challenge a Southerner, a person from the Southern states, they tend to be more aggressive in response than if you travel, if you challenge a Northern state person. So, you know, Vermont versus Texas, big difference. There's also a higher homicide rate among young white Southern men than among white Northern men in the United States. That's speculation I'm going to avoid for the moment because that's just loaded with what happens when aggression is fostered. Remember that song? Oh, what was that song? Hold on a sec. When do you have your stuff? Have something to do with testosterone, you know? You know, it almost feels like it's you're not allowed to play that on the air. Is there something uncool about that? I remember we used to dance to that. Boy, was that a dancer. You remember dancing to, what was that? The Pointer Sisters, wasn't it?
It was wonderful, sure. Great right? dance, sure.
Whatever it was, great did we have any idea what we were dancing to?
Oh, not at all. Not at all.
Behaviors like aggression can be learned by watching and imitating the behaviors of others. Now, this comes into the big thing about watching TV. If you have kids, do you say to yourself, I don't want those kids to watch aggressive television. There's going to be no killing. We're going to, parental controls. Get out the killing. Get out the murder. Right? We'll get out the porn. We'll get out all that stuff so the child doesn't have it. And then we have this remarkable phenomenon, which is, the kid winds up deciding to join the military, right? I mean, because there is some part of this you can't quell. Because the need to quell it very often comes from the parent's fear of the aggression. Now, if that's the case, if it's not a case of selective attention and you're trying to say to your kids, you know, hey, here's what I would like you to do because I want you to believe a certain thing, but, you know, aggression is part of life. I mean, I know parents, I know people who cannot watch an animal movie where there's an animal killing an animal. And if you can't keep your eyes open on a nature channel when a lion is going after a deer or something, you know, which I understand. I mean, I certainly hate seeing it because I see the powerlessness of the deer, you know. But, I mean, if you have to run away from it, if you say, shut it off, I can't look, you know, and you have to turn away from it, that indicates your fear of your own aggression. That's not just, you know, a judgment about aggression, because if you're going to limit a child's exposure to aggression, you better limit the child's exposure to nature, right? Because nature is aggressive. You know, dolphins, beautiful dolphins, eat baby fish that belong to other animals. You know, dolphins attack. They're killers. As well as they're nice. So this whole idea of watching, and they found that there is a correlation. There is a correlation between watching aggression on TV and children's later feeling of aggression. But it's hard to find the correlation because what it means is maybe the reason the kid is looking at the violent TV is because the kid is already violent. So it's very time. They did a long-term study of 700 families, and they found a significant association between the time spent watching violent television as a teenager. But this is back in 2005. What happens now when the average child on their phone is playing aggressive games like Angry Birds or Sub Hunt or things like that, and you're now in a kill or be killed over and over again obsession? Do video games inspire aggressive behavior? Or do they release and allow you to feel less aggressive? I mean, if you think about it, does lifting weights in the gym make you more aggressive? Does punching a punching bag? Does running on a track? Maybe exercise. See, you got to be... It's very hard to try to find the correlation, and the difficulty with finding a correlation is if you do find a correlation or you make one up, you're usually making it up out of your own need. I've often thought of what happens to people who are attracted to meditation, Buddhism, quiet practice, yoga. And here they start off with this, it's usually people, I'm not saying everybody, when a person decides to study themselves by finding a paradise of silence, which I could certainly understand, you could certainly learn a lot about yourself through silence. But if the reason that you're going to that meditative place is because you fear aggression, which a lot of people do, and then you make a judgment about aggression in your own head and you fear your own anger, if that's what you do, then it doesn't work. Now, I want to ask you about this, Linda. Linda, I know that you teach people yoga as well as being a psychotherapist. What happens with people's aggressive, angry feelings and yoga? I mean, does yoga work in eliminating the angry feelings, or is it sometimes a mistake?
Yes, Armand, I don't think it's a mistake. I do believe that yoga helps people to get better in touch with all of themselves, including that anger. And anger is also, it's a stimulus.
Wait a minute, do you ever see anybody in yoga punching a bag?
Well, sometimes they do. You know, we do a lot of movement and very strong movement. And so the tension that you will basically build up in your body is really a form of aggression, naturally. So therefore, you can feel the anger, and oftentimes that brings a person to great tears. It allows the person to turn that oftentimes inward anger outward. And oftentimes what happens in doing postures and getting through yoga, it will actually activate the aggression, the anger, and to be able to get it out. Now, that's a physicality. You know, that spiritual practice of meditation and quietness is something else. And I think it helps us. It doesn't eliminate it. It doesn't at all misplace it. If anything, I think it activates it and helps us to get better in touch with it. So that's an appropriate feeling. It's not one that is going to be a reactive, impulsive emotion.
I think from what I've seen, Linda, I think yoga is a wonderful tool. I mean, you, Teresa Palmer, who's actually working down there today, does a great practice around that as well in meditation. But I think there are times that it's the worst thing a person could do. I think there are times that a person has to be able to get away from the inner self, you know, and try to get to the outer self, especially very depressed people. Maybe. There are other situational factors that lead to dealing that we have to consider when we consider aggression. Alcohol impairs judgment. It makes people less cautious than they usually are. It disrupts the way the information is processed. A drinking person is much more likely to view an accidental event as a purposeful one and therefore respond more aggressively. So therefore, if you are drinking, and you'll see how argumentative drinking people become. And they become argumentative because they can't filter stuff through their brains. And what happens is, you know, if somebody, an accident happens, they think it's purposeful, they think it's about them. And they respond in a very primitive way. Not all, but frequently. And there's nothing like a bad drunk. You know, I mean, when they have this expression of bad drunk, that means somebody who's mean, who's going to come home and beat the children. You know what I mean? Pain and discomfort also increase aggression. Even the simple act of placing one's hand in warm water can encourage an aggressive response. Hot temperatures have been implicated as a factor in a number of studies. One study, completed in the middle of the civil rights movement, found that riots were more likely on hotter days than cooler ones. Students were found to be more aggressive and irritable after taking a test in a hot classroom. Drivers in cars without air conditioning were found to be more likely to honk their horns. Aggression increases if a person feels that he or she is being blocked from achieving a goal as well. Let's say you're trying to achieve a certain goal and you're going in a certain direction. One study found that closeness to the goal makes a difference. So, for example, they studied people waiting in line and concluded that the second person in line was more aggressive than the 12th one in line when somebody cut in the line. You know? And so it's the closer you get to your goal, the more aggressive you tend to be. Unexpected frustration may be another factor. In a separate study, a group of students were collecting donations over a phone, like our people are collecting the donations down at WBAI. Some of them were told that the people would call would be generous, and the collection would be very successful. The other group was given no expectations. The group with the high expectations became much more aggressive when no one was pledging. So if you're there answering phones and you're told, oh, you're going to get a lot of calls, you're going to get a lot of calls, you're going to get a lot of calls, and you're sitting around, you start getting angry. You don't know what you're getting angry at, but higher expectations will lead you to that. A new proposal links military experience to anger and aggression. Now, here's one that we don't have to think about too much, do we? Serial killers tend to have served in the military. Gee. Whiz. The military provides a social context where servicemen learn aggression, violence, and murder. We teach it. Right? You pay your taxes. We bring in a young boy or a young girl. Okay, here's how you kill. Let's teach you how to kill. Let's teach you how to be violent. Let's teach you how to be aggressive. But it also becomes another issue when the person leaves the military. Post-traumatic stress disorder is a serious issue because it's believed to lead to aggression in soldiers who are suffering from what they witnessed in battle. And this kind of aggressive response kind of stays inside you, and you can't seem to get out of it. They come back to the civilian world and are still hunted by flashbacks and nightmares, causing severe stress. And then this contributes as well to serial killing. So they're finding. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. We're kind of studying this. We do need you to go to the phones at 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950. But, you know, since we're talking about aggression, let me bring you one of my old aggressive favorite pieces. Here's 2 minutes of something worth listening to.
Hate is the kind of hate that I have for you.
My hate for you is such a hot hate. I hate you with hot, heaping hunks of hate.
The heat of your hot hate could not approximate the hateful hatred that I have in hating you.
If it was possible to write the word hate on each grain of sand in the Sahara Desert, all that hate on each of those hateful grains would equal 1/1,000,000th of the hate I'm hating you with right now.
You know how much you're hating me?
Yeah.
Double it. That's my hate for you.
I used to love you. Now I hate love.
How long have you hated me?
2 years.
I've hated you 4 years.
I hated you before I met you.
I hated you before you were born.
I hate your grandmother.
I hate Columbus for discovering America and making it possible for me to meet and hate you this way.
The word hate isn't big enough to hold
the
my hate
of hate,
for
the
you.
The gestures of hate.
Because I
in
hate
this world, not only in this world, go out into space, go out
of your body
into the universe,
are hateful.
In the Milky Way,
the
go up
air
into
you
Jupiter, into Mars.
Hateful.
All the hate, hate they have up
hangs
there.
All
will not
over
approximate
you. You've got hate hanging on you.
I have
that's
for you.
What I hate you with.
I'd like to ask one question.
What?
Do you think this marriage can be saved?
That's wonderful.
That's Stiller and Mira.
Mm-hmm.
Ben Stiller's father. And hey, 212-209-2950. There's so much to understand. Too much to understand about aggression and anger. 212-209-2950. Gender is a factor that plays a role in both human and animal aggression. Males are hysterically to believe more physically aggressive than females. Men commit the vast majority of murders. More sex difference has been found across many different age groups and cultures. Males are quicker to aggression and more likely than females to express their aggression physically. But we made sense about that before. Because the female has to be protected. Now, although women are less likely to initiate physical violence, they can express aggression by using a variety of non-physical means. Exactly which method women use to express anger is something that varies from culture to culture. On Bologna Island, a culture based on male dominance and physical violence, women tend to get into conflicts with other women more frequently than men do. When in conflict with men, instead of using physical means, they make up songs mocking the man, which spread across the island and humiliate him. That's how you get a man. If a woman wanted to kill a man, she would either convince her male relatives to kill him or hire an assassin. Although these two methods involve physical violence, both are forms of indirect aggression, which is frequent with females, and it's very frequent with passive-aggressive women. See, if you're a passive-aggressive woman, you're angry at somebody, you get somebody else to pull the trigger. Then in children, the frequency of physical aggression in human peaks at around age 2 or 3 years. It then declines, generally on average, and I think there's a correlation there between testosterone levels as well. What is typically expected of children? Young children preparing to enter kindergarten need to develop socially important skill of being assertive, but they have to be able to deal with peer pressure. Hitting or biting could be a form of communication. It has to be watched. Aggressive behavior can impede learning skills. Anyway, it all becomes too much to deal with and too much to learn. And I don't know how a mother ever gets through all this. You know, what do you do? Is it chemical? Is it physical? So much of this stuff is physical. So much of it is about the physical self. So as you can tell, there's endless amounts to learn. We have provided you with this 2 hours. We've provided you with a lot of information today, and we have 5 more hours of information available to you, which is now, we're coming to the end of our time, at 212-209-2950. His name is Bud Freeman.
Goodness, thank you so much. Armand DeMille and The Positive Mind. That 5 CD set is still available right now on Anger. And thank you very much, Linda Vanella, for your support of The Positive Mind with Armand DeMille. 212-209-2950. Let's hear a little bit more of this music, but do make your calls now. We have open lines. Marty is there, Teresa is there, the others are there. They're taking your phone calls for The Positive Mind with Armand DeMille. Make your calls right now from Westchester, Connecticut. Give us a call. That's very good. Very, very nice to see 6 calls coming in for The Positive Mind with Armand DeMille. We got to get this tally up just a little bit more. That's the only reason I'm stepping on this beautiful, beautiful music. Bud Freeman, thank you so much, Armand DeMille. The Positive Mind with Armand DeMille, Tuesdays and most Wednesdays here on WBAI. We're at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. I forgot to mention, on tally this afternoon, have a matching pledge. And you see, you have to ask for these things, and people have pledged. We have a matching pledge, what is this, of $1,000. How about that? $1,000 for The Positive Mind with Armand DeMille. 212-209-2950. Lynn Flesher Migueleta. I believe that's right. Rafael Rovira. Thank you, Raphael and Deborah. Okay, good catch. And a caller coming in from Salisbury, North Carolina, here on WB.